It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments over mail-in voting and ballot drop boxes. We'll find out what came out of the hearing and what it could mean for voting in Wisconsin. First, Amazon workers at a warehouse in New York voted to unionize earlier this month. It was the first successful unionizing effort in the big company's history. The organizers who led it were newcomers who did it without the help of an established national union. We're talking about what this win, apparently, for organized labor means and how the lessons from it could shake up future organizing efforts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this vote to unionize this one Amazon facility? Do you work in a union job yourself? Have you in the past? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Shelton is an associate professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. He's the author of Teacher Strike, Public Education in the Making of a New American Political Order. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks so much for having me today on this blustery day out there.
Quite blustery out there, definitely. Well, a big wind blowing here, maybe for Amazon. Sorry about that transition. This factory organized, there have been a lot of efforts in the past to try to organize by bigger outside unions to try to organize facilities. How big a deal now is this news from New York?
Look, this is a huge deal. I mean, as you mentioned, Amazon is, this enormous company. You know, its primary owner, Jeff Bezos, is one of the richest people in the world. I think he's the second richest person now after Elon Musk. And there's warehouses all across this country. And so for these workers to win a union election, in spite of all of the stops the company pulled out to try and stop them from winning that election, it's huge and sets a precedent. You know, one of the things that's been reported is that the Amazon labor union is now getting calls from Amazon workers all across the country asking, how do we organize, our warehouse? How do we organize at our place of employment? And, as you said, the fact that this was an independent effort, is causing a lot of people out there to kind of rethink what they know about, how these sorts of efforts can be won. And so it's an enormous moment.
This, as you say, this was a local effort started by workers from the warehouse, as opposed to what we often, I think of the model as that outside big labor organization comes in, helps organize the facility. How significant is that difference?
It's significant. I mean, I think the dichotomy, the way some people are framing it, is a little bit overblown. Because, typically when there is, an organizing drive, oftentimes, a national union will lend support to that organizing effort. I mean, there are best practices, that unions in lots of different sectors, know about and know the best way to do it. So I don't want to understate the importance of having those outside resources. And any union drive that's going to be successful, it's not like, outside organizers come in and trick people into, voting for the union. What happens is there always has to be a sustained effort by workers at that workplace, to win the election. So I think to a certain extent, there's been a false dichotomy here. But it is true that a lot of pundits kind of said, well, without outside support, because the company has so many resources. I mean, Amazon held countless numbers of folks in the industry call captive audience meetings, where, the company on, workers' time at work, they basically, tell them all the reasons they shouldn't join a union. And so the Amazon workers, they actually crowdsourced funding for some of the materials. They got, pro bono help from labor attorneys. And so it did look like an operation that didn't have nearly as many resources. I mean, if there's a real David and Goliath story that we've seen in the labor movement in the past few years, this is definitely one of them. But I will say one of the things that might have worked to the advantage of the workers at Amazon is one of the things that employers often do at these captive audience meetings is they tell workers, you're going to be paying dues to this outside entity, this outside organization. Now, as I said before, that's not really how this works. Typically outside, support is just that. It's support for workers who are already organizing. But I think that it's possible. We'd have to kind of, you know, do some more research on this. And I'm sure people will in the weeks and years to come. But, you know, it's possible that sort of standard objection that employers often use, hey, this is some outside entity that just wants your dues. There's no way to make that argument when, you know, there's literally no outside affiliation, right? So I think it's possible that might have been something that factored into this.
Talking to John Shelton from UW Green Bay, looking at the union effort at a Amazon facility in New York, the first successful unionization of an Amazon facility. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to listen to one of the organizers in New York talking about the decision to make their own union. This is Derek Palmer talking to the New York Times earlier this week.
We knew it was going to be hard. It was harder, you know, obviously resources, you know, money. That's what big unions provide. But the fact that we're the workers and we can connect with them, that's all we need to really know. The rest we just going to have to do. You know, it's going to be harder for us, but I'd rather do that and fail on our terms than going behind a big union and watch them make mistakes that we know are mistakes and allow them to continue that.
And that's been a concern from workers at the Bessemer plant, the Amazon plant that fell short in Alabama on a unionization effort. The sense that the people coming in from outside didn't get the local workers and maybe didn't take them seriously enough. Is that a lesson for a big union looking to work with Amazon plants in the future?
Yeah, I don't know if we can necessarily, you know, make that deduction. I mean, you know, we're talking about vastly different efforts here, right? And first of all, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think the second Bessemer vote has been finalized yet. I know that, you know, the anti-union folks have a lead, but there's still a bunch of contested ballots, and so it's still possible actually that you know the union there wins the election. But certainly, you know, the workers didn't win the last time, the pro-union workers didn't win the last time they had an election. But, you know, this is sort of an apples and oranges kind of comparison. I mean, for one thing, we're talking about the South, which has, you know, had a very long history of deeply anti-union ideology in a way that, you know, New York City, you know, there's certainly anti-union folks there and anti-union employers, but that sort of anti-union ideology hasn't quite been as pronounced in a place like New York. But, you know, I think it's a worthwhile question to study to what extent, you know, the union down in Alabama, you know, coming in and helping organize, you know, might have been, you know, not as attentive to the rhythms of workers there. But, you know, one of the big things, I mean, there was in Staten Island, one of the big things that I think from what all I've seen kind of moved the needle is there was a National Labor Relations Board decision which guaranteed workers at the Amazon warehouse time to actually make the case to other workers about the union. And oftentimes in the past, it's been, you know, unions and organizing, even workers at a workplace have had significant limits on their ability to talk to their coworkers. And so, you know, part of this really does get to how labor law works in this country and how, you know, frankly, labor law is really, you know, sort of weighted on the side of employers at this point. So, you know, I think we'll learn more about, you know, the differences with Bessemer. But, you know, to me, the big takeaway here is workers win when they organize. You know, if you look at how unions are perceived in this country, unions have their highest approval rating since the 1960s. Economic inequality has exploded in the last 30 or 40 years. And actually almost half of Republicans see unions as being favorable, right? Because they recognize, I think more and more people are recognizing that unions are a significant part of the answer to reducing economic inequality and making sure that working people have long-term economic security. And so, you know, I think what cuts through all that is when workers at a specific workplace can talk to each other, can share stories about what it is that's actually making their working conditions difficult. You know, at Amazon, I know one of the points of contention is how limited their bathroom breaks are. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, only workers at a work site can really speak to experiences like that and those sorts of common experiences. And so I think whatever happens, that's the real takeaway here, is that it's the workers at Amazon and Staten Island that put the time into talking to each other and organizing in order to win this election.
We're talking to John Shelton, associate professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay, with us to talk about the vote to unionize an Amazon warehouse in New York, what it means for the broader labor movement. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more Amazon facilities, other workplaces get represented, get union representation? Have you worked on an organizing drive at some point in your career yourself? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the vote to unionize an Amazon warehouse in New York, the first successful unionization vote in the company's history. John Shelton is with us from UW Green Bay. You can join in with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hello.
Good afternoon, folks. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a member of the IBEW since 1989. I've worked towards on organizing campaigns. I've helped out. I wish more people would, but I am so proud of those people in New York. I mean, they did what they felt was the best for them, and that's the biggest thing. You have to look at this as, this is how they felt, but better themselves. I applaud them.
Pat, thanks for the call. John, Pat saying a logical call to better their positions in the workplace.
Yeah, Pat, thanks so much for calling in, because you make such an important point. You know, one of the things that I think too many people take for granted in this country is that we shouldn't have the ability to affect our work lives, right? And that we shouldn't have a say in our working conditions, and that, you know, we're just lucky to have jobs. But, you know, I think to your point, one of the things that I find so fascinating about what the Amazon workers here did is they said our workplace should be more democratic. We should have more control over our work hours. We should have more workplace safety. We should have higher pay, particularly when a company like Amazon is making so much in profits and have profited so much over the past 2 years. And to me, that's in many ways the story of American democracy. Is workers thinking about how that extends to the workplace. And you're absolutely right. These workers at Amazon did that.
Pat, thanks for the call. Jim joins us now in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm retired. I come out of the paper industry. USW was my last union I was affiliated with. And when I listened to this, I sat at the negotiation table six different times in my 38 years. I listened to this, and a union, I was told by a rep one time, is no stronger than its body. The union reps and that are just the governing to give you guidance. And so many people is that, oh, I belong to the union, they got to do this for me. And then that's it. And then they complain about paying the due. I'll go back again. It's no stronger than its body. If the body is weak, it isn't going to last. You're not going to have much say. You're not going to get much accomplished.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. John, he's talking to, I think, passively being a member of a union and actively being a member of a union.
Yeah, Jim, I'm really glad that you called in and made that point, because it's really important. I mean, oftentimes when people talk about unions, even people who are union members, they say, well, the union is this outside entity that comes in and does things for me. But the reality is what gives a union power isn't who its elected leader is. It isn't even the, collective bargaining relationship they have with their employer. What gives it power is the fact that you have, a collection of individual workers all coming together and pushing for the same thing. And that's really what this election represents. So I really appreciate you making that point. And I think I think more folks, when they're thinking about unions and they're thinking about, you know, how unions build power and you know, where they don't build power, they would do well to remember your point here.
Thanks for that call, Jim. John, I think if there was a movie, it would end after that successful union vote. This isn't a movie. There's a lot more that has to happen now. What happens with a new entity like this, a new union? How do the negotiations go then with their employers, Amazon?
Yeah, Rob, I'm so glad that you asked this question, that we have time to talk about this, because there has been a lot of, you know, sort of celebration about this, and rightly so. I mean, again, a successful union vote against Amazon is a true David and Goliath story. But, you know, some of the stuff I was talking about before in terms of the limitations on labor law really come into play here, and we have to think about this moving forward. And this actually may be where the Amazon Workers Union's decision to kind of go it alone could cause them some problems. So, you know, the way labor law works is workers at a, and this comes out of the 1930s, and it's been changed a little bit, but it's more or less the same as it's been since the 30s. Workers decide to have an election. They need 30% of folks at a worksite to call for an election. They hold an election. If a majority of the workers vote in the union, that union then is the exclusive representative for all the workers there. But once they become the exclusive representative, the employer, they're, according to the law, they're supposed to bargain in good faith. But one of the weaknesses of labor law, especially since the 1960s and 70s, is that there's nothing to compel the employer to bargain in good faith with the union. So I can almost guarantee you here that what Amazon is going to do is stall the negotiating process. They're not going to you know, easily decide to agree on a collectively bargained contract with the union. So, you know, there are some best practices that, you know, sort of national unions can often help locals with when they're dealing with this kind of recalcitrance. But if the union is going to continue to be successful, if these workers are going to continue to be successful and get that first contract, which is really important, a significant number of union elections end up with union representation, but then the employer doesn't agree to a first contract and they can kind of fizzle out. So, you know, what's really going to be important here, to go back to the point of the last caller, is that these workers are going to have to continue to organize. They may need to do, you know, some kind of job action, like a walkout. That doesn't necessarily mean an open-ended strike, but a walkout or, you know, a sick out or something going all the way up to the level of a strike, which, by the way, they have the right to go on strike under labor law in order to provide leverage to get the employer to collectively bargain. Something like that's going to have to happen. And so back to this point of a union's only as strong as its rank and file, its body, to the point of the previous caller, that's what's going to have to happen here in order for the workers to get a contract.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeff is with us in La Crosse. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, I have a, I'm not sure how unions would tackle this, but it's just the overall inequity within organizations where you've got the CEOs making millions and the guys really doing all the work on the floor are the ones that are actually making the profit for them. So there's such an imbalance, and I really don't know how that gets taken care of, but you don't need $2 million or don't need $1 million a year to live on. I don't care who we are.
Jeff, thanks for the call. John, can organized labor in one outlet or even company-wide make a difference in this, what Jeff sees as an inequity in pay between those at the top and those on the floor?
Yeah, well, Jeff, thanks for the call. I mean, I think you gave us all the material we need to, like, understand this question. I mean, so I was just reading in the New York Times this weekend that, you know, for the average worker who makes about $35,000 a year in this country to attain the same wealth as Jeff Bezos, they would need to work for something like 4 million years in order to attain the wealth that he has now. But what you said when you framed, you know, who does the actual work, I think is really important. So while Jeff Bezos was thinking about how to go up in a rocket ship, and this is something that, you know, Chris Smalls, one of the organizers at Amazon, pointed out, they were busy organizing. And, you know, I'll be honest, like, Amazon can't function. It cannot do the things that it does without the people working in its distribution centers. And so if those people, you know, organize and push for an agreement that's going to give them a bigger piece of the profits that Amazon is making, then that they can change that dynamic. And now imagine every Amazon warehouse in this country doing that. And now, and then imagine every Starbucks outlet doing that, and leading to many other you know, workplaces doing that. And imagine how that could lead to tackling that problem that you pointed out.
Thanks for that call. We have just a few moments left. A caller on the line bringing up the Colectivo union effort in Milwaukee. You mentioned the Starbucks chain staying in the coffee world. Very different kind of company in both of those cases than Amazon. What are your thoughts just briefly on what those might mean, John?
Sure. Well, the difference there, of course, is Amazon warehouses are much larger than your average coffee retailer, right? So Colectivo Coffee, you know, is, you know, a few retail outlets. Starbucks, you know, you've had dozens of successful votes for Starbucks to unionize, no contracts yet. And lots of Starbucks outlets, the workers there, you know, wanting to organize. The what makes that a little bit more difficult is that you've got a lot of smaller workplaces. And so I think long term, one of the things that, you know, a lot of people looking at labor are pointing out is that we might want to think about pushing for more sectoral negotiations. So you could imagine, say, all of the Starbucks workers in the country working together to create a better agreement with the company that, you know, creates more sustainable livelihoods and better wages and better working conditions. You know, there's precedent for that. In a lot of European countries, they have sectoral bargaining agreements, and we're far away from that. But I think long term, that may be something that we want to think about. And then you could imagine how, like, a big agreement that covers Starbucks workers, that becomes relevant for smaller chains like Colectivo, because the kind of agreements they need to make would be kind of pegged to that, if that makes sense. So long term, I think, you know, that would be something that would really move the needle for workers too.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Everybody stay warm out there.
That's John Shelton from UW Green Bay with us today to talk about the significance of the first successful vote to unionize Amazon workers in one facility, this one in New York, what it could mean for the labor movement in the United States. Up next, ballot drop boxes and mail-in voting rules are up for debate by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We'll learn more about the arguments and possible outcomes. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, where did the empathy go? We'll find out how empathy can be good for us and good for our health, and how it can make a comeback. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in a lawsuit challenging the ways that absentee ballots and drop boxes can be used in the state's elections. The court previously issued a temporary ruling in January allowing drop boxes to be used in the February primary, but a second temporary ruling restricted their use in the general election last week. The justices plan to make a final ruling to be in place for the August primary and November midterm elections. We're recapping the arguments the justices heard yesterday, learning more about what's at stake. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow those arguments in court? What do you think they should and shouldn't allow? Are you in favor of ballot drop boxes? If so, how should they be used? Where? How should they be monitored? How about the ways that absentee ballots get returned? Should it be okay for your spouse, say, or significant other to walk your ballot over to the mailbox for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Madison Law School. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, walk us through the process. What took these issues back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
Well, this litigation began in a trial court in Waukesha County. There were two voters who challenged practices that had been in place in 2020. There were a couple of memos that the Wisconsin Election Commission issued that advised municipal clerks that they could choose to make drop boxes available for the receipt of absentee votes, and also indicated that it was okay for voters to have family members or other individuals turn in absentee ballots for them. And the voters challenged that guidance. The Waukesha court ruled in favor of those voters, and then the case headed up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Let's stay with Dropboxes for a minute. What do we know about what state law does and doesn't say about how and whether Dropboxes can be used for elections?
So state law does not mention Dropboxes by name. That term isn't used in state law. Instead, what state law says is that absentee ballots can be delivered to the municipal clerk. And the question is whether that means that the municipal clerks have some discretion to decide exactly how they want to receive those absentee ballots that are hand delivered. Do they actually have to have an exchange where they directly take them from the voter? Or can they say, you know, our preferred mechanism or one of the available mechanisms for receipt is to set up a secure box either in the clerk's office in a municipal building or possibly at another location. So the question is essentially whether they have that flexibility or not under the state law.
What do we hear on arguments from both sides on this?
Well, the argument that you hear from the challengers is essentially because state law is silent on this, because it requires delivery to be in person to the clerk, they think that the statute should be read to require the physical exchange of a ballot from the voter to the clerk. And they say that the fact that there is no specific provision for drop boxes means that they shouldn't be allowed. Now, the argument that you hear from the other side is that essentially the clerk is the receiver here, and they should have some ability to decide on the receipt method. And this was something that, again, was used in 2020 with guidance from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. And at that time in 2020, there were no objections raised prior to the election. And so the challengers now say, well, everyone seemed to accept that this was okay beforehand, and it's unclear why the objections are belatedly being raised now.
Oh, this got pretty granular. During the arguments yesterday, I want to give a listen to part of it. Justice Brian Hagedorn here going through some hypothetical ballot scenarios with attorney Rick Essenberg from the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty representing the challengers here. Let's take a listen.
Inside the clerk's office staff during business hours, freestanding drop box. Clerk says, all right, looks good. Go ahead and put your ballot in there. Is that okay?
I think that a drop box that we can say is staffed by the clerk. It is in the presence of the clerk.
Okay.
A clerk can see what's going on.
So that's good.
I think that would be delivered to the clerk, although, again, it ultimately is for this court to decide.
So now you're in a municipal building. Where I go vote, municipal clerk's office is inside the broader municipal building. Okay? And imagine a mail slot connected to the clerk's office, but staff's not there. Can you drop a ballot in that slot that goes directly to the clerk's office? Is that okay?
No, I mean, at this point, we are now outside the presence of the clerk.
Okay.
And so the delivery would not be in person.
So, okay, so for you, essential is staff present. Is that right?
With respect to that aspect.
Okay.
So, a lot of fine points, and that wasn't the only example of these details. I don't know. Is the court going to give really precise definitions of a clerk-personed Dropbox site?
You know, that's one way that the court could go. The court could try to really delineate in fine detail exactly what is and isn't allowed, because the challengers in this case have basically acknowledged that you don't literally have to have a voter put the ballot into the hand of the clerk. They've said that it would be okay, for example, for the clerk to have an inbox on their desk. And so then you start to get these questions about line drawing. And well, if that's okay, then can you have the Dropbox that is situated just outside the office, but in view of a clerk? And then if that's okay, can it be outside the door of the building? And so it is possible that you'll get the court try to articulate the brightest line that it can. The other direction that the court could go is to say, you know what, these granular decisions actually are ones that are left to the municipal clerks to make. And as long as they're acting reasonably and within the guidance that they get from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, then the court won't second guess it in that kind of detail.
Talking to Rob Yablon with the UW-Madison Law School about a Supreme Court hearing yesterday looking at ballot drop boxes and the chain of connection when absentee ballots are brought in, sent in, mailed in. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What should be allowed? What should not be allowed? What questions do you have? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Rob, the other big deal yesterday was If I am, you know, not going in to drop it off in person, I'm not voting in person, I've got an absentee ballot, I want it to be delivered to my clerk. A lot of questions about who I hand it to, who can bring it for me, what kind of things are at stake here?
Right. Well, so this is the other issue. And the position that the challengers take here is that it needs to be the voter himself or herself who either puts it into the mail or is the one who is physically delivering it to the clerk in whatever fashion is allowed. And that you can't have assistance of any form in their view, whether it's from a family member, a caregiver, or anyone else. And the argument on the other side is that the law just requires these absentee ballots to be delivered in person. It doesn't specify who that person would be. And as long as the delivery is occurring in person by someone, whether it is your spouse, whether it is your caregiver, that actually is more consistent with the spirit of absentee voting. One of the reasons that we make an absentee voting option available is because we realize that some people are going to have difficulty getting to a polling place or to a clerk's office. And so if they need some assistance, the defenders of this broader view say, well, they should be able to have that assistance.
And this covers a lot of ground. Anything from, hey, honey, can you drop our ballots off in the mailbox to, hey, we've got this organized effort to rally voters and we're going to collect up all their votes and drop them off. Sometimes that's called ballot harvesting. What did we hear along that spectrum of okay versus not okay?
Yeah, well, so, you know, you've got that spectrum exactly right. And the justices who seem more sympathetic to the idea that assistance should be allowed focused on the most sympathetic examples, which is, you know, shouldn't your spouse be able to put something in the mailbox for you? On the flip side, the justices that are somewhat more skeptical focused on this, you know, ballot harvesting kind of scenario where you might have an orchestrated effort by potentially unscrupulous actors to collect ballots en masse and turn them in. Now, even that sort of effort isn't necessarily going to result in fraud if all that is really being done is that ballots that have been voted by the individual or sealed are just being turned in by someone else. But, you know, the challengers here are raising the specter of the possibility that then undue influence is exercised. Someone comes to your door and they actually now are participating in the process of you filling out the ballot, which they shouldn't do. Maybe an unscrupulous person is taking your ballot and not turning it in as you hope that they will. Now, there are other state laws that are going to address that kind of misconduct, but the challenger's position, I think, would essentially be that saying that it has to be you yourself turning in the ballot adds another safeguard into the system.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Yeah, a couple points. It seems ridiculous to me that my town hall where I vote is a quarter mile away, and I would have to mail my ballot, go through Minneapolis and back a quarter mile away to get my ballot, my absentee ballot registered. And my question is, doesn't the statute give the WEAC or agency that regulates elections some leeway on regulatory, formulation?
Jimmy, thanks. The WEC, I think he means the Wisconsin Elections Commission. How much, that's a huge part of the story, Rob. How much leeway do they have?
Right. And they certainly do have, I mean, their job is to implement state election law. And the question that is really at the heart of this case is when there is an arguable lack of clarity in that state election law, to what extent are they allowed to fill the gaps? And conversely, to what extent are they just simply sidelined if state law isn't clear about something.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about Wisconsin Supreme Court arguments yesterday over ballot drop boxes in elections, plus how absentee ballots get from point A, the voter, to point B, the clerk. UW-Madison Law Professor Rob Yablon is with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run up against these issues as you cast your own ballots this last couple of years? Do you work at a clerk's office? What are your thoughts on all this? What questions, what hopes do you have in this case? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our talk now with Robert Yablon. He's a law professor at UW-Madison with us today to talk about state Supreme arguments over mail-in ballots and the use of drop boxes in Wisconsin elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I have a question. If my husband cannot ride in the car with me and drop my ballot as well as his ballot in the mailbox, my question is, what about a housebound person who lives out in the country, is nowhere near a postal drop box, and is not able to drive and is not able to go to any place in order to drop off an absentee ballot? Can they put it in their mailbox, and can their mail carrier pick it up and put it in the mail? Is that considered somebody else dropping it off?
Stella, thanks for the call. And Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the answer is yes, that the postal delivery person can pick up your ballot and deliver it. Do I have that right?
That's right. The postal delivery person can pick it up, and that's okay. Might not be okay if the challengers prevail in this case is that housebound person couldn't have their caregiver walk the ballot out to the mailbox. They somehow would have to be able to do that themselves or somehow get the mail carrier to come to their door. And so there are situations in which this can create real hardships for people who have physical limitations. You know, you can imagine someone who is paralyzed, for example, and simply relies on other people to perform some of these tasks. And it is not clear how, as a matter of state law, they would be accommodated. Now, let me say that in addition to state law, there are some federal law protections here under the Voting Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the arguments about the scope of those laws haven't really been litigated fully in this case. So there may still be some federal law protections for such individuals.
Thanks for that call. That leads into a moment yesterday. I want to give a listen again. Attorney Rick Essenberg with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty here being questioned by Justice Jill Karofsky about voters who have disabilities.
We have examples of individuals who have indicated that they need somebody to pick up their ballot for them, but we know that it is possible for such persons to mail a ballot. We know that it is possible for them to arrange for pickup in the United States Postal Service if they are disabled. And so if you need someone to pick up your ballot for you, there's no reason that it can't be a mail carrier.
But what I'm hearing you say is that if someone is disabled and cannot get to their mailbox, they cannot have someone else take the envelope and put it in their mailbox.
They can if it's a mail carrier, just in the same way as I can mail something, I can place something
but
in the
mail carrier doesn't
whichever
come.
Term you want to use, by giving it to a postal carrier.
And the suggestion is, I guess, that the postal carrier can come into your house to your, I guess, sick bed and take the ballot out of your hands. That's a concern that came up, and groups that represent people with disabilities have raised these concerns.
That's exactly right. I'm not sure that I have a complete understanding of this. I do think that there are some situations when it may be possible for individuals to get accommodations from postal carriers so that they will come to the door rather than leaving mail at the street. But I think that there are also instances in which people are not able to get that the kind of service that they would need to literally have a handover from them directly to a postal carrier.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Sharon is with us in Madison. Sharon, hi.
Hi. My example is my own mother. She was in a nursing home. She was bedridden with rheumatoid arthritis. She had voted in every election from the time I was a small child. She had all of her cognitive ability, and she wanted to vote. And in this day and age, how in the world would she have gotten her ballot to a mailbox or to a clerk, a city clerk?
Sharon, thanks for that call. COVID gave an extra wrinkle of that, Rob. You know, we have special voting deputies who can go into nursing homes. COVID limited that, a whole nother controversy that we've talked about on the show in the past. What are your thoughts for Sharon?
Well, again, there are absolutely going to be individuals who have serious hardships trying to cast an absentee vote if the challenger's position prevails here. We did hear some stories of people who came forward after the recent election a couple of weeks ago and said that they ended up not being able to cast a vote because the decision from the trial court was in effect for the April election. So, you know, for some people, it's just a matter of convenience to be able to have a spouse deliver your ballot for you. But for other people, they truly are reliant on other individuals to do some of these tasks for them. And it is not clear exactly how they would be accommodated if the challenger's position prevails.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. We'll go next to Pat in Appleton. Pat, hi.
Hi, I am a poll worker. And I want to know if no one else can put your ballot in the mailboxes, are they going to put cameras on every mailbox that you have to hold up your mail and show who it's coming from?
Pat, I gotcha. Thanks for the call, Pat. Rob, I think the question of enforcement, how do you enforce a thing that says, no, you can't hand it to your, say, spouse to put into the mailbox for you? How would anybody know?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is something that the municipal clerks were trying to figure out during the election a couple of weeks ago, because there is no enforcement mechanism provided in state law. And the defenders of the idea that you should be allowed to have other people do this say, well, you know, if state law really meant to be limited in this way, you'd think that they would have had some mechanism that they articulated for how this would be monitored. And so, you know, there were some municipal clerks, for example, that required people to show IDs when they were turning in their absentee ballots. Now, there is an ID requirement in state law, but not at that stage of the election. And so some people thought that was actually improper for the clerks to be doing that. I mean, this really is something that is not clearly, there's no clear enforcement mechanism as the law is written.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Nate on the line in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I was going to say that I've dropped off both my ballot and a family member myself, and making that illegal strikes me not only as ridiculous, but I think that we should treat trying to deny people their ability to vote as not just a violation of their rights, but is also trying to cheat in the election, because arguably is trying to change the election results, just instead of by adding fake votes, removing real votes. And as for the legal aspect, you know, there's no law specifically allowing me to do jumping jacks, but I'm pretty sure it's not illegal for me to do that.
Nate, thanks for the call. He mentioned potentially violating voting rights here, Rob, and you've touched on that. There are protections for voting rights under federal law. If somebody, say, wasn't able to vote in the April election, what remedy do they have? No matter if they go into the federal court system now, they're not going to get that vote back, are they?
That vote is probably not, they're not going to be able to vote belatedly. They might seek prospective relief. They may note that they were disenfranchised in the April election. They want to vote in future elections, and they seek an accommodation of some kind. And so we could see further litigation along those lines. The caller points out something very important as we think about fairness in elections. On one hand, a fair election is one in which people who should not vote don't vote, but on the other hand is one where everyone who wants to vote and is entitled to do so is able to. And it really is a fairness problem when people who are eligible are excluded. And so, those who are defending the Dropbox law, who are defending the ability to turn in ballots for other people, are suggesting that actually there could be some real unfairness that results if we constrain absentee voting too much.
Thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Rob, we've got until our primary elections now later in the summer. Do you think this ruling, whenever it comes out from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, is going to be the last word on these issues? Or are we going to be here talking about this again, I don't know, come election time?
My guess is that it won't be entirely the last word, because as I mentioned, there are these federal law issues that I'm not sure that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is going to fully resolve. Now, if the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling here is to reverse the lower court and to say that yes, drop boxes are okay, yes, assistance is okay, then it's possible that that will be the last word. But to the extent that they are imposing restrictions that may make it difficult or impossible for some people to cast votes, I imagine that we will see some follow-on litigation about that.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good talking to you.
That's Robert Yablon, associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. He was with us today breaking down the arguments the state Supreme Court heard yesterday over the use of ballot drop boxes and mail-in and absentee voting in Wisconsin elections. You can keep following that story and many more over at WPR.org with our state Capitol News team. Keep up with the latest news from Wisconsin and the world each weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Coming up tomorrow, a Wisconsin expert answers children's questions about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're getting ready to do surgery, you should also be ready to rock. Here's a little study I'm interested in, published in the journal Langenbeck's Archives of Surgery. I read it every edition. Apparently, surgical teams often listen to music during surgery. I didn't know that. I've only ever been on the receiving end of surgery. I wasn't awake enough to hear if there was music. Anyhow, the researchers wondered, does playing music help the surgery go better? And does the kind of music matter? They trained surgeons on a particular kind of laparoscopic surgery and then tested them using a surgical testing device. And they tried different musical settings. None? Soft music and loud music, and the Beatles versus AC/DC. The conclusion, the surgeons did better with some music versus no music, and by some measures, the best result came with hard rock played loud. Hey man, is that surgery rock? Well, turn it up. This is Central Time.